Good morning, this is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for David Inge. Glad you could tune in today. When George W. Bush and his crew took over the foreign policy reins, they took the U.S. on a new course, unilateralism. As the only remaining superpower and economic leader of the world, America could go it alone. We backed out of the Kyoto Protocol on climate change, the International Criminal Court Treaty, even the International Biological Weapons Protocol. Then came the morning of September 11th. Suddenly, the U.S. needs the rest of the world. Heck, on October 5th, we even paid back most of our back dues to the United Nations. Questions for this hour of Focus 580. How do the events of September 11th affect the direction of U.S. foreign policy? Does this moment represent a true paradigm shift in our relations with the rest of the world, a moment when America finally understands the meaning of the word globalization? Or, assuming this crisis eventually passes, will we again retreat to attend merely to our own self-interests and hope the rest of the world can straighten itself out without our involvement? Questions surely too big for us to answer during the next hour, but that never stopped us from trying. Our guest during this hour is someone who has worked for many years on issues of human rights, sovereignty, and international law. Doug Castle is director of the Center for International Human Rights at Northwestern University. He's also president of the Due Process of Law Foundation and vice president of the Board of Justice Studies Center of the Americas, to which he was elected by the Organization of American States. He has served as consultant on human rights to the United Nations, the OAS, the U.S. State Department, and the Ford Foundation, and has lectured throughout Europe, Asia, and the Americas. He's also served as legal advisor to the UN Commission on the Truth in El Salvador, where he supervised investigations and was the principal editor of its report. He also has a weekly commentary heard every Wednesday on WBEZ in Chicago, the NPR station up there. As we talk during this hour with Doug Castle, you are invited into the conversation. Your questions and comments on the topic are welcome. All you have to do is call us around Champaign-Urbana at 333-9455. That's 333-WILL if you match the letters with the numbers. Also, toll-free anywhere you hear us around Illinois, Indiana, parts of the other states we reach with our AM 580 signal. The number toll-free, 800-222-9455. Again, around Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-WILL. Doug Castle, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
To begin, let's talk about U.S. foreign policy before and after September 11th. Have I overstated this change of course business?
A little bit. I think September 11 is a watershed, dramatically altering U.S. foreign policy, not only in the weeks since then, but for the foreseeable future, certainly years and probably decades to come. The one point where I think the intro may have overstated it a bit is the suggestion that we may have finally come to understand the meaning of globalization. I think we're a far cry from that yet, but I think, on the other hand, we have gone from viewing the world through predominantly unilateralist eyes to a new foreign policy that understands the significance of multilateralism in the new world.
Mm-hmm. Well, prior to September 11th, I mean, you note in some of your commentaries that the U.S. was essentially retreating from a number of international agreements and, you know, sort of taking a new tack.
I wouldn't use the word retreating. I would say that the United States before September 11 perceived itself, and in some ways correctly so, as a superpower unrivaled in history, going back to perhaps the Roman Empire, where measured by the military terms that applied before September 11 and measured by economic and diplomatic terms, the United States towered so high above the rest of the world that we felt, and to some extent correctly so for that period of time, that we were able to do pretty much whatever we wanted on our own and did not have to resort to alliances, to treaties, to international law, to international organizations, except if we happened to perceive some particular situation where it might suit our interests. What's changed after September 11, far more than the policy, is the reality that underlies it, because the reality after September 11 is that military power in the world has been redefined. It is no longer measured by the number of nuclear bombs and aircraft carriers you have, but it can be measured by the determination of a small number of people to board civilian passenger jets with box cutters, or to hide out in some suburb in New Jersey and stick some anthrax spores in a few envelopes. Once military power gets redefined in that way, what it does is to greatly reduce the military power disparity between the United States and the rest of the world.
I'm interested in hearing you talk about the legal authority under which we are operating in the international arena and how perhaps that has changed or our thinking about has changed since September 11th.
Well, international law is essentially a way of expressing two things. Number one, international agreement, the agreement of a large number of nations in the world. And number two, a commitment by those nations to regard themselves as being bound by the agreement. Pre-September 11, the United States didn't care terribly much what most other nations thought most of the time. And in those instances where the nations of the world had gotten together and entered into treaties and other forms of international law, the United States did not feel itself particularly bound by those, except, again, when it was perceived to be in our self-interest. After September 11, I think the Bush administration and Secretary Powell, to their credit, have realized that given our number one current foreign policy priority, which is the campaign against international terrorism, that is a priority that can best be advanced in a multilateral and multinational manner. And that means that we now do care about what other countries think. And we also have to care about what international law says, because that's the embodiment of the strongest consensus reached by the international community. So, for example, do we want to engage in military actions in Afghanistan or elsewhere against terrorism? If we do, we need bases nearby. We need overflight permission from Pakistan and other countries. We need overflight for our logistical supply lines. We need bases for our aircraft carriers. All of that means we have to care what other countries in the region think of us and are prepared to agree with us about. Do we wish to fight international terrorism by the law enforcement route? Well, then we need help with sharing of evidence, arresting of suspects wherever they may be found, conducting law enforcement investigations in many countries. If people are in fact identified and arrested, then we need help with extradition. We may ultimately need help with the question of where they might be put on trial. All of those questions, again, we cannot handle single-handedly. We have to enter into agreements with other nations, and those agreements will have to operate within a framework that has already been defined by international law. Suppose our battle against terrorism is on the intelligence front, and of course it's on all three of these fronts, military, law enforcement, and intelligence. Our intelligence agencies have some strengths and some weaknesses. Their strengths are primarily in the electronic eavesdropping area, but that's not enough to deal with terrorists like the Bin Laden group, which are smart enough to use means of communication that cannot be detected from satellites. So we also need human sources, and there, unfortunately, the CIA is extremely weak, particularly in the Arab world and particularly among the extremist Islamic groups who are the base of Al-Qaeda and some of these other terrorist groups. And so we need cooperation from Egyptian intelligence, from Jordanian intelligence, from other intelligence agencies of Arabic-speaking and Islamic countries. And again, we're not going to be able to force that single-handedly. We have to work in a cooperative mode. Now, you add all these things together, and what you get is a pretty obvious case for the need to pursue a multilateral policy in regard to our number one national priority in foreign policy, campaigning against terrorism. And once you build that set of multilateral ties, agreements, discussions, personal relationships, rapport, trust, etc., It has an inherent tendency to expand to other areas of our foreign policy. First, because other nations demand that as a quid pro quo. They may tell us they're happy to help us on terrorism, but then they'd like a hand from us on some other issue. And secondly, because once you begin to build these relationships and build these networks, they have a sort of a self-perpetuating momentum. Diplomats get to know each other better. They get to trust each other better. They work together better. It becomes a little more awkward to do things behind someone's back or without consulting them. So for all of these reasons, I think that we are not looking at a scenario where the U.S. will wage an intensive campaign against terrorism for, say, 6 months or a year, theoretically or hypothetically win that campaign, and then go back to business as usual pre-September 11. I think we have turned a corner and there's no going back.
Okay. We're talking this morning with Doug Castle. He's director of the Center for International Human Rights at Northwestern University. And we're talking about U.S. foreign policy in the wake of September 11th. We do have one caller waiting, and we'll get right to them. Others are welcome. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Elsewhere, 800-222-9455. We have a listener on a car phone on I-57, so rather than make them run off the road, let's include them in the conversation. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
I guess I've lost it.
Hello?
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 Yes, you there? Is a caller there? Well, we did have a caller there. That person is welcome to call back. We sort of had them, but I guess they didn't have us. Well, let me then continue along the previous question. In the case of the war in Yugoslavia, there were quite a bit of people worried that the United States and NATO were pursuing military action, perhaps in violation of international law, the UN Charter, and so forth. What is different about the current campaign with regard to the activities, the military campaign in Afghanistan and perhaps elsewhere with regard to international law in this case?
Well, I was one of the people who thought the NATO military action against Yugoslavia in regard to Kosovo was a violation of the United Nations Charter. I didn't think that because it was violating Yugoslav sovereignty. I think that Yugoslavia had forfeited whatever right to sovereignty it had by virtue of having committed crimes against humanity in Kosovo justifying humanitarian intervention. So the violation was not of the rights of Yugoslavia, but rather of the rights of the rest of the world who have a right under the United Nations Charter to have international use of force limited to two circumstances. One is self-defense, and in Yugoslavia we were not going in as a matter of self-defense. Yugoslavia was not attacking us. Mm-hmm. And the other is by authorization of the United Nations Security Council acting under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, which authorizes the Council to take military action or to authorize military action in cases of threats to international peace and security. There was no Security Council authorization for the intervention in Yugoslavia either. So I argued that NATO could not usurp the powers of the UN Security Council, and the intervention was illegal as a matter of law, in my opinion. Afghanistan, however, is quite a different matter. On September 11, as everyone knows, we were massively, brutally, and viciously attacked. The United Nations Charter recognizes the inherent right to self-defense, and that right of self-defense does not authorize you to retaliate for something that is over and done with, but it does authorize you to take military action necessary to protect yourself from a continuing threat. And in the case of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan harboring bin Laden, and in the case of bin Laden and his al-Qaeda group, clearly, unless we put them out of business, there's every reason to expect them to just keep committing terrorist acts. They've been doing it for years. They're publicly committed to doing it. And so as a matter of self-defense, in my opinion, under the UN Charter and international law, the United States has every right to go into Afghanistan, provided that it was not reasonably possible to resolve the conflict with the Taliban and bin Laden by diplomatic means, which it was not. And provided that in the course of going in there, we respect international law in terms of making every effort to avoid civilian casualties and hitting military targets with proportionate force. And in my opinion, we are meeting both of those criteria as well. So I view the military action in Afghanistan, unlike the one connected with Kosovo, as entirely justified under international law and being conducted in a manner consistent with international law.
Very good. We have several callers to include in our conversation, and I think we have our person on I-57 back on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes, thank you.
Sure.
Sorry, I just must have been in between towers.
Okay.
I'd like to say that I agree with all the conclusions that your guest has made, with the exception of one, and his conclusion was that this was not a sudden revelation. He took exception with your introduction. I think your introduction was right on. As a matter of fact, I think that many of the actions that were being taken by the Bush administration reflected exactly what you had said. And I think that there was a revelation on the part of many of the conservative and, or generally speaking, Republican group that we were going to go it alone. And I think that they did perceive themselves as you compare to the times of the Roman Empire. I think that they did see themselves in that way, and there's some truth to it, but that doesn't reflect the fact that that we do need people, and it's a shame that it took the collapse of these towers and this kind of an attack to bring them to that realization. And I think that that is what did bring them to that realization, because I think they were on a path of rejecting the need for other people in the world and a lack of concern and a high degree of arrogance in regard to other people around the world.
I agree entirely with everything your caller just said. I wasn't disagreeing at all that September 11 was a moment of revelation. It was, and it has drastically altered the approach to U.S. foreign policy. The only exception I was taking was with any suggestion that even today Washington understands globalization. For two reasons. First of all, I don't think anybody understands globalization. It's far more complex and rapidly developing than I think even the best analysts can keep up with. But secondly, I don't think the Bush administration or Washington is up to speed even with the best thinking that's been done in policy analysis circles. I think they've come a great distance since September 11, but I think they still have a ways to go. Just to give you one example, as part of the deal by which Tom DeLay and Jesse Helms and some others agreed to allow George Bush to pay the installment of our UN dues in early September, as was mentioned in the introduction, there was a condition on that deal, and the condition was that the Bush administration would have to proclaim its support, which it has now done, for something called the American Service Members Protection Act, which is basically a bill declaring war on the International Criminal Court that is supported by all of our democratic allies, and which would go so far as to authorize the President of the United States to use military force to liberate any American who might someday be detained for the International Criminal Court. Now, that is, aside from the fact that we ought to be supporting the International Criminal Court rather than opposing it, that is just spitting in the face of our European and democratic allies around the world.
Absolutely.
And so I would suggest that while the Bush administration has learned a great deal since September 11, it still has a ways to go.
Oh, I absolutely agree with that. I think that's a good conclusion. In regard to policy, maybe something a little more closer to what's happening right now, and that's the bombing that's going on in regard to the people that are very hungry and, in fact, starving, that are unable to get food for due to the bombing and a lot of other reasons. But if I guess I make a comment and a request for information, I'm concerned that we are going to continue this, and that right now 7 million people are in jeopardy, and if we do continuation of this, and 7 million people, in fact, do die of starvation as a direct or indirect, if you will, of our actions, I'm very concerned that the world will never forgive us, and we should never forgive ourselves. If there's not a plan, do you think that there is a plan, a contingency plan, that will take take consideration of these people and do so rapidly?
I don't think there is a plan currently in place that's designed to deal with starvation on the scale of 7 million people. But we're not at that point yet, and I think there are contingency plans in place to try to prevent us from reaching that stage. I don't think we'll ever reach that stage for two reasons. First of all, it would be a humanitarian disaster on an unthinkable scale. And I don't think that Washington would permit itself to be associated in any way with such a calamity.
I would hope not.
But secondly, even if Washington had no particular humanitarian sensitivity, it would be a great way to lose this war. And by this war, I don't mean necessarily what happens in Afghanistan. I mean what happens in the war for public opinion, particularly, but not only, in the Arab and Muslim world.
Absolutely.
The government of President Musharraf in Pakistan, in the scenario you describe, would almost certainly fall and be taken over by forces much more sympathetic to the Taliban and hostile to us. One would have to wonder about the stability of other governments in the Islamic and Arab world, and we would certainly lose the support of public opinion even in Europe. So you're right, we have to be very concerned about the scenario you portray and take action and develop plans to nip it in the bud before it reaches that stage. But on the other hand, I think it is virtually certain that we will do that, because the consequences of not doing it are unacceptable, either in human terms or geopolitical terms.
Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks very much for your call. We're almost halfway in our conversation with Doug Castle, director of the Center for International Human Rights at Northwestern University. We're talking about U.S. foreign policy in the wake of September 11th. We have a couple callers waiting and time for others if you'd like to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Savoy on line number 2. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hi. How you doing?
Good.
Hey, I've been following your talk today, and I kind of take issue with the supposed fact that these terrorists were military geniuses and have the same standing in terms of military terms as the United States. If you go and you look at what the enabling action was to make their plan successful, it was they relied upon the fact that no one on board would be armed. And that's the thing that really allowed that to take place. After that, everything was set in motion. We can't think of these terrorists as political, having any political or human standing at all. And, I'm surprised that we can give them so much credit. And I'd like to know how you came to that conclusion.
Well, I didn't suggest that they were equivalent to the United States in military prowess. No one is, if military prowess is defined as armed forces and military equipment have traditionally been defined. My point is that the definition of military capability has now been redefined. You no longer have to be well-equipped, well-trained, highly professional, well-armed, well-financed, all of the things that the United States is and has been. You no longer have to be that to pose a very serious military threat to another country. You can take a few zealots, squirrel them away for 18 months and sneak them onto an airplane with some box cutters, which was I think their only weapon, as far as I can recall, or other low-tech methods, and you're capable of killing 6,000 people in a single day, as they did. So I'm not suggesting that they are equal by any means in military terms. What I'm suggesting is that their military capability in a very different way poses a far greater threat to us than the conventional military capabilities of countries did before September 11. In terms of giving them any political or military standing, certainly politically they deserve no standing whatsoever. They're criminals. They should be captured and prosecuted if they resist by military force, which they're currently doing now. They should be the object of military operations. The Bin Laden group has no political standing, and even the Taliban is not recognized by any government in the world, with the sole exception of Pakistan. And Pakistan's relationship with the Taliban now is mostly a sort of a useful channel of communication, because it's the only country where the Taliban still has an ambassador who can speak and be spoken to. In terms of human terms, I'm not sure what you mean by that, but I guess I would say that from my point of view and from the point of view of international human rights law, every human being, no matter how evil their actions may have been, is still a human being with certain basic human rights. So as much as I deplore and detest the terrorists for what they have done, I recognize them as human beings entitled to the basic human rights that any member of the human family has. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't be bombing their military forces. We're doing that. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't be attempting to arrest and prosecute them. We're doing that, but they're still human beings.
Apologies to the last caller, but we have several other people waiting. I want to try to include as many people as we can in the time remaining. We'll go next to a listener in Bloomington on line number 4. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Good morning.
Yes.
Bush has said that his war against terrorism will go on for years and years, has he not?
Yes.
All right. Certainly he does not believe that Afghanistan will take years and years, does he?
No.
Well, then, who is he going after Afghanistan? Now, in my opinion, he is building this coalition with these Muslim countries that he has formerly said were terrorists, or harboring terrorists. Now, my reading of it is that he intends to pick these nations off one at a time over the years. Can you reassure me that that is not the case?
I don't believe that's the case. When he uses the word war, it's ambiguous. In one sense, of course, it refers to the actual kind of war that we all recognize, with bombs falling and missiles and jets and so forth, that's taking place right now in Afghanistan. But I think when he said the war on terrorism will go on for years, he was referring to a metaphorical kind of war to be waged by intelligence, law enforcement, diplomacy, economics, and other means not limited to military. So assuming, and I have to stress assuming, because I think the outcome in Afghanistan for many reasons remains uncertain, but assuming that he is able to win the military war in Afghanistan sometime in the next few weeks or months, he will then face the question of by what means to continue waging the war against international terrorism in years to come, because we'll have no choice but to wage that war, because they are certainly going to continue waging it against us. They've been doing it for years. It reached a peak on September 11. But there are hundreds and thousands of determined zealots looking for ways to commit violent, terrorist, murderous acts against the United States. They'll keep it up on their side, so we have to keep it up on our side. But that does not necessarily mean that the means by which we wage our side of the war, once the Afghanistan chapter is more or less resolved, will have to be military. It could be by a whole range of other means. I wouldn't rule out military, perhaps in a case or two. It might come to that. But I think the Bush administration is likely to be very, very leery of trying to take further military action in the Arab or Islamic world, because in the course of waging this war and hopefully winning it in Afghanistan, we are further arousing widespread resentment against us throughout the Arab and Muslim world. And if we are able to bring the Afghanistan chapter to a close, I think we'll have an awful lot of bridge building to do in that part of the world and attacking some other country, even if we have justification, which we might well have, probably would be counterproductive in the region.
Well, you have drawn a different conclusion from the fact that we already know. You have drawn a different conclusion than I have, and you are much more sanguine about it than I am, sir. I have to repeat what I said originally. I think that's what's in their minds, that they'll pick these Arab countries off, Muslim countries off one at a time, after they're successful in one instance and then another.
Well, we're talking crystal balls.
Thank you for taking my opinion.
Okay.
Sure. I don't claim that my crystal ball is perfect. Nobody's is. But the main reason why I am as optimistic on that point as I am is that I think the Bush administration is very much aware that when you attack, as we are currently doing, one Muslim country, it has very serious and obvious negative consequences in other Muslim countries, so that they can see that happening now, and they know what the cost they would have to pay would be were they to try to do it again.
Yeah, well one hopes that that's the way it is in the administration. One does read a lot of commentary by people who say, well, this is just the beginning. I remember when we first began launching attack military strikes in Afghanistan in earlier this month, some analysts were saying, yeah, this is just the beginning, where, you know, next is going to have to be Libya and Iran, and, you know, we're going to have to go back to Iraq and so forth. And the other thing I wanted to raise is, now people are talking about Ramadan is coming up, and there is going to be more pressure for the United States to cease military strikes in Afghanistan, partly because of that, and also because after Ramadan comes a winter, and that's going to be a much more difficult scenario to continue prosecuting the military action in Afghanistan. Do you have any thoughts on how, you know, what's likely to happen? How are we likely to deal with these considerations?
Well, first of all, on the commentary and advocacy calling for continued military action against other Arab countries, I think there are, if you will, hawks and doves within the administration.
Mm-hmm.
From day one, Assistant Secretary of Defense Paul Wolfowitz has been identified with the hawk faction, and there are commentators who, like Charles Krauthammer, who are with him, calling for military action against any and all countries that support terrorism. But his views have not prevailed within the administration. The views of Colin Powell seem to be more in accord with those of Condoleezza Rice and George Bush. Rumsfeld has scaled back his rhetoric from the early days. So I think the administration has been able to take a broader and, in my view, a more intelligent assessment of our strategic posture than some of those who are calling for precipitous or imprudent military action. In terms of Ramadan, I'm quite worried. As you know, there have been public statements by Rumsfeld to the effect that in the past, Muslim countries themselves have carried out wars during Ramadan, implying that if they can do it, so can we. There have been statements coming out of the Pentagon that this war might go for at least into the middle of 2002. I think it is good for those things to be said now publicly, because you don't want to send a public message to the Taliban that all they have to do is hold out until the beginning of Ramadan in November and they'll be home free. You want to send them a message that's going to make them worried that come the beginning of Ramadan, they don't suddenly have a shelter. So I think publicly making those statements is probably a good idea. But in terms of what we actually do, I'm extremely worried that already the costs of this war and of the way in which we're conducting this war at a fairly slow pace, unfortunately, is exacting a high toll in Arab and Muslim public opinion, especially but not only in Pakistan, and that will become far, far worse if we continue through Ramadan. So I think even though we may publicly say that we're prepared to continue into Ramadan, I think we ought to be making every effort to wrap this thing up, if at all possible, before Ramadan, and I don't know whether that's going to be possible.
Okay. We have a couple of the callers waiting, and just about 13 or 14 minutes left in this hour. We're talking, once again, I should mention, with Doug Castle, Director of the Center for International Human Rights at Northwestern University, and we're talking about U.S. foreign policy in the wake of September 11th and a variety of issues that that pertains. If you would like to join us, we should have time to take a couple more calls. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll free anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. We'll go next to a listener in Champaign on line number two. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. Just for the sake of moral consistency, during the 1980s, when the United States was funding terrorist Contras to attack Nicaragua, would you have supported the right of, if they were capable, would you have supported the right of the elected and representative government of Nicaragua, known as the Sandinistas, would you have supported their right to bomb the United States at that time?
It depends on whether they were bombing military targets in the United States. If they had, I think the United States was engaged in a de facto proxy war utilizing both military and terrorist means against Nicaragua.
Was that the case in the 1980s?
That's what I said. I said the United States was in fact.
What were you doing? I mean,
let's let the guest answer. I think he's addressing your question. Let's give him a chance here.
Yeah, I mean, the question you're raising is entirely hypothetical because, of course, the Sandinistas did not have the capability to bomb the United States in the 1980s.
But if they had,
which is the hypothetical you pose, in my view, it would have been a lawful act of self-defense for them to do so, provided they were attacking military targets. So if they had hypothetically bombed a U.S. military base in response to the war that was being waged against them under the sponsorship of the United States, I think that would have been a lawful act of self-defense. On the other hand, if they had flown an airplane into the World Trade Center, it doesn't matter what your reason for doing something like that is. That's just illegal terrorism, immoral terrorism. Nobody can be allowed to do that, no matter what their reason is. So,
you're calling the U.S. support of the Contras illegal and immoral terrorism in the 1980s?
Was I?
Yeah.
Yes, I was.
Were you calling the Israeli invasion of Lebanon illegal and immoral terrorism in the 1980s?
Well, I don't think I made any public statements about the Lebanon invasion in the 1980s, but a little earlier this year I took some flack, in fact a considerable amount of flack, because I suggested that Ariel Sharon should be arrested and prosecuted as a war criminal based on the findings of the Kahan Commission in Israel, which determined that he had a degree of responsibility for the killings of several hundred Palestinians in the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps, which in my opinion equates under international law to command responsibility, the responsibility of a military commander for actions by troops under his control. So I certainly at this point in time and during the 1990s, I've been sharply critical of the crimes against humanity committed under Sharon's direction at Sabra and Shatila in 1982.
Apologies to the caller, but we have about 10 minutes left, and we have some more callers I want to include in our conversation. Quick follow-up, though, along the lines of the point of the caller. You were very much involved in the Commission on the Truth in El Salvador, including writing the final report of that.
Okay,
thank you for that clarification. But, you know, the point being that your experience gives you good insight into the U.S. track record in Central America, certainly with regard to human rights violations. And I think that we know pretty clearly the U.S. does not have a totally clean record when it comes to supporting terrorists, what people could certainly call the Contras in Central America, and perhaps other regimes that were guilty of human rights violations there and elsewhere around the world. And so I guess my question is, if you agree or disagree with that, you can state your point of view. But given that a lot of people do perceive us as a nation that has has engaged in foreign policy that has violated people's human rights, it does create a little bit of a complicated situation now when we try to uphold those standards of human rights.
It certainly does. I mean, I get myself in trouble with both the State Department and with anti-war and groups opposed to the United States government all the time because my positions are consistently in support of neither side. My views are that we have to support human rights everywhere all the time, and we have to oppose violations of human rights by anyone, ever, anywhere. Sometimes, in fact, on quite a number of occasions, the United States government is guilty of that in places, or has been, in places like Nicaragua, Guatemala, El Salvador, and elsewhere, currently in Colombia. But there are other times when the United States is acting, I think, in defense of human rights and within the boundaries of international law, and Afghanistan is such a case. So the world does not, in my view, break down into black and white, all or nothing. The United States is neither always right nor always wrong. We have, unfortunately, a track record of frequent and flagrant disregard for international law and for international human rights law, which considerably undermines our credibility, most unfortunately, when in fact we are acting in support of human rights and within the bounds of international law as we currently are. But I don't think the fact that we have been wrong in many other places means that our government should not be supported when it's doing something right. I believe that what it's doing in Afghanistan right now, in broad terms, is right.
Okay. We have a couple of the callers. Let's go next to a listener in Aurora on line number one. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. What is the intent of not declaring this a war? And one of the countries right behind Afghanistan, one other country that hates us as much as Afghanistan, and why did you say Arab and the Muslim world? Why did you make that distinction?
Because the Muslim world is not limited to the Arab world. Afghanistan is not an Arab country. Pakistan is not an Arab country, nor is Iran, nor is Indonesia, which is the largest Muslim country in the world. So when we look at the reactions of public opinion in countries that perceive themselves as more closely linked to the Afghan people than, say, the people of Europe do, we have to look both at the Arab world, which has which is almost exclusively Muslim, and therefore strongly identifies with the Muslim population of Afghanistan. But we also have to look at that part of the Muslim world, which is a very important part of the Muslim world, which is not part of the Arab world. Now, on your first question, why did we not declare war? That is a question purely of national law within the U.S. International law doesn't really care whether someone formally declares war or simply engages in war. And so I've been analyzing what Washington is doing, and for purposes of international law, it doesn't make any difference at all whether Washington chooses to make a formal declaration of war or simply has the president get up and make a speech about war and then start sending in the missiles and the bombs. In terms of domestic U.S. law and politics, why did we not declare war? I have to confess to you, I don't know. I haven't talked to anybody in Washington to ask them why they didn't do that. And that's not my area of specialization.
Okay. We have a couple of the calls. We'll try to get them both in 5 minutes or so remaining. Next is a listener in Schaumburg on line number four. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Yes. My question has to do with biological warfare. Anthrax and smallpox are the two that seem to be in focus right now. Is there a lot of others that could come to the forefront? That's one question. The other question is, I was born in 1943, and we were all vaccinated at that time against smallpox. Is that vaccination still effective, or will we need, if necessary, to get vaccinated again?
Well, I'm not either a medical or a bio expert, but I did hear on NPR this morning an interview with a medical expert who said that the last of vaccinations that were widespread in the United States were ended in 1972, and that the concern of the medical community is that those vaccinations no longer shield people like you and me from smallpox. So if you had your vaccination as I did decades before that, I think we have to assume, based on what I heard this morning, that that vaccination is no longer valid. The United States does currently have a stockpile, as I understand it, of something like 10 million doses of smallpox vaccine, and they are preparing an experiment now to see whether that can be diluted so that it would reach as many as 75 million vaccinations. Plus, they are in the process of contracting for an additional supply of vaccinations. Now, in terms of our smallpox, which fortunately has not yet broken out, and anthrax, which has, are they the only two forms of bioterrorism to worry about? Certainly not. Even without being a biological expert, I can be confident that there are many other types of bacterial, viral, and other sorts of insidious bio warfare that we have to worry about, and that I'm sure that the government is looking into. Am I sure that the government will not be caught off guard by some new form of bioterrorism? No, I'm not sure of that. I wish I were, but unfortunately, we've been operating under the safe assumption for many years that this sort of thing was so inhuman that nobody would be likely to do it. We now know that that's no longer the case, and we have to take these threats as being far more imminent, serious, and realistic today than we might have a few years ago.
We have less than 2 minutes left. We have one last caller I'll try to squeeze in here and just have to ask that person to try to be brief with the question. This is someone in Crystal Lake on line number two. Good morning.
The only solution to this terrorism is for the corporations and the U.S. and its military backed by our government is to get out of unfair trade in foreign countries, because these large multinationals export sweatshops and take in their resources, like in in Nigeria, and they get the oil, and any opposition or revolt, say, the corporations, these large ones, quell with our troops. In fact, in East Timor, they had the workers with the South Korean generals at the workplace, and who wants that? But we have sweatshops and slave labor, really, that way.
I'm going to have to cut off the caller because we're running out of time, but I think her point is that our economic policy has also been an issue in terms of the way that the United States is perceived around the world, and maybe that's part of the problem as well.
I agree, and I think the caller has, by coincidence, sort of brought us back to the point that you opened with. One of the major reasons for anger against the United States in many countries around the world, but particularly in the Arab world, is economic underdevelopment, massive unemployment in those countries, resulting in part and perceived to result from a market-dominated system of globalization where the most advanced and competitive countries, namely the United States, Europe, and certain East Asian countries, including Japan, have a built-in advantage over countries like most of the Arab world, which are not really yet competitive. And the result of opening up world markets to open competition in that sort of an uneven contest is that we, the United States and other advanced countries, tend to win, and the countries in the Arab world tend to lose, and people there not quite understandably get very angry at us. I think that is one of the lessons which the Bush administration has not really fully absorbed yet, and that's why I regard September 11 as a major turning point, but I think we still have some more turns that we'll need to make in the road.
Okay, well, we're going to have to leave it there since we're here at the end of our time, and I'm sure we'll continue talking about these issues, and we want to thank you very much for spending the time with us. Our guest has been Doug Castle, Director of the Center for International Human Rights at Northwestern University. Thanks so much.
Thank you.